Hello, I'm Dr. David Johnson, Professor of Medicine and Chief of Gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia, and welcome back to another computer consult. Well, I'm just back from the National Digestive Disease Week in Chicago, and this is a consortium of the GI and Surgical Societies, and I've already put forward my highlights for the gastroenterology specialist, but what I've done in the past after national meetings is also put forth a highlight that are messages that really primary care physicians would really be interested as a high-level discussion from the national meetings that you can put into practice application, I think, now. And so I've put together my top 10 list, if you will, not in any order, so just in the sequence, I'm going to give you my top 10 of messages that I think will be helpful for primary care application from the National Gastroenterology Meeting, and really to put this in perspective. The first of which was a prospective study that came looking at patients that are postmenopausal women. And the question was, what do PPIs do to bone mineral metabolism? And we've all heard lots of noise on this, and particularly many patients have stopped this. This is a prospective study looking at the effects of esomeprazole or dexlansoprazole versus placebo, 26 weeks of treatment, exposure that is, these are non-symptomatic patients, against placebo, and the reevaluation both at 26 and 52 weeks. The bottom line was, ready? No difference. And this is very much consistent with what we've seen now in prospective studies. I think this bone density thing needs to go away, and certainly there are lots of studies now to support in prospective evaluation that our patients should not be concerned about this, nor do we monitor people any differently for this. So again, raise this for your patients, reassure them. If they need the medicine, they should take it. If they don't, they shouldn't. The second was one that I really found interesting was on diaphragmatic breathing, and this is in the case of treatment of patients with refractory belching or hiccups, Cingultis. And this is something that I've discussed previously on another computer consult, and I'll send you this link or I'll attach this link with today's discussion. But now this is a prospective evaluation, and this is coming from Singapore, but they looked at the evaluation of diaphragmatic breathing. Real quick and easy, you put your hand on your chest, you have the patient breathe, not move the chest excursion, but the hand on the abdomen. It's belly breathing is what I tell patients. It's a form of yoga, but it is extraordinarily helpful in patients with rumination syndrome. But I've had similar success in patients with belching and in refractory patients with hiccups. So again, something primary care could be aware of. Again, refer to my link on this and a little more programmatic teaching on this, but it's something that I think will be helpful for you. The third was a discussion in a retrospective analysis on post-bariatric surgery patients and thiamine deficiency. So these investigators from Washington found that there was thiamine deficiency evident in about 12 to 15% of their patients when studied with programmatic way in post-bariatric surgery. Now, very importantly, this includes both gastric bypass, but also gastric sleeve resection, which is kind of the more vogue treatment, at least for most bariatric surgeons. For primary care, it's very important because there are still surgeons that don't programmatically follow these people up. For primary care, it's very important that you understand any GI symptoms need to be evaluated with a whole blood thiamine level. If they come into the emergency room with nausea, vomiting, they need to get thiamine as you would treat an alcoholic, the same way with the idea that they may be thiamine deficient, because these patients can precipitate something like Wernicke's encephalopathy. So any GI symptom, and in fact, some of these patients, 12%, also had neurologic or cardiovascular symptoms as they presented. So again, think about thiamine deficiency in any evaluation from a neurologic, GI, cardiovascular. Thiamine deficiency needs to have a high suspect, and the test is a whole blood thiamine level. So you need to order a whole blood thiamine. Again, interesting, and something that came out of this meeting. Again, reiterative of what we've known before, but illustrative of the same point. The fourth was alcohol and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Before you freak out and be aware of what you tell your patients, mild amount of alcohol in these patients was actually shown to be beneficial. And they looked at a national database using the NHANES evaluation, and this is something that programmatically they could say that patients did better with very mild amounts of alcohol, so a half to one drink a day. More than that was not so good. So be careful at how you counsel patients. The counsel for NAFLD patients is lose weight, good control of cholesterol, diabetes, it's the metabolic type things. But again, weight loss is really important. Caffeine has been shown to be important. I've profiled this previously also in some of my Medscape comments. But again, a little bit of alcohol, don't take away their dinner wine if they like that. The fifth is an alert more for the use of increasing use of statins in patients with liver disease, in particular with cirrhosis. And so don't be alarmed when you see patients coming back from the gastroenterologist, but also don't be hesitant to use statins in patients even with cirrhosis. We do have good data that shows that statins decrease the decompensation and mortality, and there was more evaluation now in particular outside of the data for hepatitis C, but looking at hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and alcohol-related cirrhosis from a population-based study that came from Taiwan. And again, expanded use of statins, appropriate use of statins in your patients that have liver disease. I think it's always helpful to correspond with your gastroenterologist, but there shouldn't be any reticence to use statins in this patient population. There's actually another paper that I won't profile that actually talked about an add-in and resulting in decreased portal pressures in portal hypertensive patients. The next one in the particular sequence now is number six, was the recognition that hepatitis B reactivation occurs, in particular when patients get chemotherapy, immunosuppressants, in particular some of the chemotherapeutic agents, immunosuppression with biologics, and immunosuppressants with steroids. And where it would play out in primary care is looking for reactivation concerns in patients that have had previous hepatitis B. Be it treated or reactivated, and from the core antibody status, these patients need to be monitored. And I'll attach a guideline for you to review because I think it's really important. You may be the only person that's out there recognizing the reason for these patients needing to be referred back to a gastroenterologist and potential co-therapy during the treatment for the oncologic or the immunosuppressive area. And again, be wary when you start giving steroids out, these patients may reactivate. The seventh study was actually, seventh abstract was one looking at, again, primary care really needs to take a lead on this, the high prevalence of advanced fibrosis where these patients had non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So advanced fibrosis means that these patients had considerable scarring, and recognized fatty liver can result in an upregulation of cytokines and inflammatory mediators that lead to actually cirrhosis. And in the next decade, this will be the leading cause for transplantation of the liver in the U.S. because we've done so well in eradication of hepatitis C and better as control of hepatitis B. So again, fatty liver needs to be looked for in particular in these patients that have this metabolic syndrome. And it particularly was notable that the composite of hepatitis, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, was greater as far as the fibrosis and advanced fatty liver disease than the entire population of patients with hepatitis C and hepatitis B combined. So again, think about fibro scanning or looking at a FIB4 score. Again, you can Google search FIB4. These are things, are ways that you can do non-invasive testing. Your gastroenterologist may have the access to a FibroScan. Again, be looking hard for advanced fibrosis. Don't rely on liver enzymes to guide you that these patients may be in trouble or impending trouble. The eighth abstract was one on celiac disease, and I realize that most primary care aren't the primary care providers for celiac, but you may see these patients in follow-up. And one of the concerns was infection, and this particular was increased odds ratios for Clostridium difficile. We see this in so many patients. Why not C. diff in the celiac population? We do know that the celiac patients are more predisposed to increased infections, such as pneumococcus and tuberculosis and influenza. But this particular study coming from New York showed that there is a odds ratio that was nearly fourfold increase within a year of the diagnosis of celiac disease of being diagnosed with C. diff. So again, low threshold to screen for C. diff, independent of the antibiotic exposures and the other exposures in the hospitalized patients. Remember, C. diff may be increased in the celiac population. The ninth was a very interesting study from Mayo that said that the risk of myocardial infarction and congestive heart failure was increased in inflammatory bowel patients. So again, you're following inflammatory bowel patients with your gastroenterologist, presumably. But this is a study that highlighted that these patients may have a very much heightened increased risk for cardiovascular disease. And the odds ratio was about 1.9 times greater. And it was co-adjusted for the standard risks that we see for diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, family history, BMI. So independent of anything else, the inflammatory bowel disease increased the risk for cardiovascular disease. So again, reassess these symptoms, even in younger patients, and think about cardiovascular disease. We used to, in the last couple of years, there was some increased interest in looking at CRP levels in cardiovascular patients as an indicator for advanced cardiovascular disease. And CRP levels, as you recognize, are also increased in the inflammatory bowel patients. So an upregulation of these cytokines may be overlapping. In particular, think about cardiovascular disease and in the IBD patient, don't dismiss it and actually ask for these patients about cardiovascular symptoms. The last is as it relates to the performance of the new test, which is not so new now, but the immunochemical fecal occult blood test, which is the test that really should replace the standard guaiac-based testing, but it's an immunohistochemical test for hemoglobin. And this is something that now is the FIT test, and we've been participating in the guidelines on this, and it's replaced all the guideline recommendations from fecal occult blood testing. But this is a study that came from Belgium and looked at the implications of using FIT tests in patients that were on antithrombotics or anticoagulants. And the answer was that there was no difference as far as the positivity rate. You don't need to stop these agents in advance of FIT testing, and you do need to respond to those patients that are FIT positive as you would with a standard recommendation that should be colonoscopy. So my top 10, hopefully, for the primary care group has set some at least guidance for you and what you should look for your patients that have some GI symptoms or GI diseases. And hopefully this provides you some guidance. These articles hopefully will be an evolution from the national meeting abstract presentation, but I wanted to have you share this information first because I thought it was really hot stuff. I'm Dr. David Johnson. Hope this is helpful. I look forward to seeing you next time on Computer Consult. Thanks again for listening.